Okay, good evening. I hope everybody had a nice Pesach and back in the swing of things, even though it's not quite yet Zman HaAviv hasn't yet arrived, but maybe on Shavuos we'll get. But anyway, just hope everyone is doing well. I just want to make brief mention of a couple of upcoming Torah in Motion programs. You all have the flyer on the program on medical ethics, on beginning of life issues, which we really have four specialists from four totally different areas: legal, psychological, medical, and Jewish. To discuss, so it'll be sort of an evening of case studies, issues relating to beginning of life. Even if you're not a doctor involved in the healthcare field, you have an interest in the field, we invite you to come. Also, we haven't 100% finalized the exact date, but it looks like May the 17th, the Thursday night. We're going to have actually Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Yehuda. I'm sure there are very few people who've heard of him in the room. You've heard of him. He's in Boca Raton now. He teaches in Boca Raton, and but his he's going to come and speak. He learned the Chavrusa with the Chazon Ish for approximately 10 years. There are very few people ever who learned with him, and who are alive in 2007, there are even fewer. So he's going to talk about his experiences being a Chavrusa of the Chazon Ish, the Gadol Hador, at least in the Haredi community at the time of the establishment of the State of Israel. So that is most likely going to be on Thursday night, May 17th. We'll be on email. We'll keep you all posted. Which brings you to, I think, a few of you probably saw we had an E-team demonstration that Shalom Eisenstadt was, running for the programs we have online that are beginning a week from Monday, I believe. A week Thursday, the 26th of April, is going to be the first one. And this is really unbelievable stuff. You sit in your living room, and it's 100% interactive. Those of you who had an opportunity to see Mark Shapiro was there in West Hempstead. People were in West Orange. People were talking to him. So I encourage that. It's a really... you don't have to go anywhere. You can sit home. Our speakers don't have to go anywhere, and it's 100% interactive. You can ask questions. You can write in questions in the middle of the talk, which you can't even do in a live lecture. You're right on the screen. So I encourage everybody to take a look at that. And those are some of the programs we have upcoming, and of course, keep you posted by emails, etc. That's to our evening's program. I think for people in my generation, Yom HaShoah is difficult to relate to. Thank God I have the fortune of coming from a family that's been living in Toronto for over 100 years. On some sides of the family, both sides of the family were out, 95% of the families were out in the 1920s. There were a few extended cousins, who of course were killed, unfortunately, Ein Bayit. But by and large, our family did well, as the saying would go. And being of a generation that grew up in the carefree, in the 70s and the 80s, it's hard for us to relate. I remember a number of years ago, Barrow Wine made the comment, now that the hockey playoffs are started, he said, when people are so interested in the Rangers, it's very hard, he lived in New York, it's very hard to talk about Yom HaShoah to high school students. Their interests are not there, and I think that's a challenge we have, especially those of us who are younger. And really that's why we decided we wanted to do a program on Yom HaShoah relating to some of the issues. And it was actually Mark Shapiro who recommended we bring in Rabbi Pollack, who is a child survivor of Bergen-Belsen at a very young age, which you'll hear about in a moment. Unfortunately, lost many members of his family, including his own father, who he really never knew, because of the Holocaust. And he has spent his life, dedicated his life to Jewish education, the director of the Boston Hillel for 37 years, I believe. and we were having a very interesting conversation in the afternoon. Really, a native of Montreal, and who has is teaching the next generation, the young generation of all denominations, all classes of Jews to get along. As one family was saying, how beautiful it works and in Boston, and it's really a privilege of ours to have him here. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce him to speak on the morning after the Holocaust.
I wasn't born in Montreal. I was born in Europe. And I thank you for inviting me here. And I knew that I was in Toronto when I got onto an elevator and this older lady says to me, stares at me, say, what are you staring at? She says, you look exactly like my fifth husband. I said, how many times have you been married? She said, four. This is an old Montreal joke that I just remembered. It's very special for me to be here in Toronto. I still had some, I don't know why I'm joking, I still had some Canadian change that I needed to get rid of. It took me 30 years to become an American citizen. Really took me 30 years. And then I realized I just wasn't Canadian anymore. It was over. And it's a special privilege for me to be in Toronto because this is a city of survivors. The city has, as far as I know, the largest gathering of survivors of the Holocaust outside of New York. And I have this fantasy that I'm the youngest of the survivors. It's not a correct fantasy, but I sometimes feel that way, and when I speak that way. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to try to do. I was almost 3 years old when the Holocaust ended, and I probably have 2-3 memories of that time and those days. But I have amazingly lucid memories of what I call the morning after. Primo Levi wrote about 1945. In fact, there's a film about him doing that. And another Polish writer, Henryk Greenberg, has also written, and he has a good word. He calls it the sequel to the Holocaust. So I've decided that as I talk about the Holocaust, I'm going to talk about the sequel. And I discovered it was a good thing to do because the Holocaust as a whole is not a manageable discipline that anybody can imagine and think through. It's too big. It is too awesome. And doing it this way, looking from the perspective of a child growing up in Holland, 1945 to 1948, those are the memories you're going to get. And it's a way to look back and to see what really happened. It's important to understand that the moment of when the war ended, it was on the radio, it was in the papers, and what did it mean to the people that the war ended? What did that mean to anybody? The streets were the same, the sun and the moon were the same, and the line of 1945, April, May, whatever, is so artificial. And it was still going on for people. And it went on for years. My mother and I wound up, as I'll tell you in a few minutes, in Montreal, deep in December 1948. And it was still going on. It was still going on. And it probably went on in a very significant and powerful way until about 1960. And in 1960 or 61, Elie Wiesel, Night came out. And what's his name? The historian at the University of Vermont, Adam, who am I thinking of? Hilbert. Raoul Hilbert's book came out on the destruction of European Jewry. That came out also. But at that point, some of the survivors were kind of coming to. So that too was an interesting time, but that I'm not talking about. I'm talking about the moment after the Holocaust. This is a piece of a memoir that I'm writing. I think I'm going to call it an autobiography, I don't remember. Starting from my actual, the memoir starts in heaven, where I am told I have to come down into the world, and I say I don't want to go. I mean, look what's going on there. Through till 1953, from 1942 or 41 until 1953. And it has, and I'm going to read you excerpts from that. That's going to be the bulk of what I'm reading to you. And then when I'm done with that, I want to do a little Torah with you, because I think that Jews should do Torah and to try and reflect what it is we can understand about God and about history after the Holocaust. And my attempts will not satisfy anybody. They certainly don't satisfy me. But we go on. Finally, in the way of this introduction, I would like to tell you something about a concentration camp that I was in, because it comes up in the text. And not everybody knows about this concentration camp. It's called Westerbork. Westerbork was a transit camp in Holland. Holland had 135,000 Jews before the Holocaust, of whom 102,000 perished. Percentage-wise, it was the highest number of Jews ever killed in all of Western Europe, percentage-wise. And it had to have been the weirdest place on earth. It was not a death camp. There was what to eat. During that time, over 100,000 Jews passed through there on their way to Treblinka, on their way to Auschwitz. While you were there, there were never more than a dozen SS officers for these thousands of people that came through all the time. Camp was run entirely by Jews, German Jews. And you got there and you filled in the cards with where you're from and your name and so on. And then you were assigned to a barrack and maybe some work. And the deal was not to get on any of the deportation lists. Every Monday night, a train rolled into the barracks, into the camp, and it had to be filled on Tuesday morning. And when, and what used to happen is that on Monday nights, the various Jews in charge of different barracks were given lists. And they read the lists in the barrack on Monday night. And some people committed suicide when they heard their name. And some people went with enormous dignity. And some people just fell apart and wept. Nobody knew for sure where everybody was going. But it became quite clear when they were sending children without their parents that this was no labor camp that anybody was going to. And Tuesday morning, by 11 o'clock, the train was gone. And everybody who wasn't on the list sighed with relief. And on Wednesday night, in the camp, there was the cabaret. And everybody in the camp was invited to the cabaret. There was an unlimited budget for the cabaret. A friend of mine, who lives on kibbutz in Israel, was in charge of going to Amsterdam and buying the materials and the props. And the finest cabaret artists of Germany were in Westerbork. And they put on spectacular shows, and we have films of it. We have films of those shows. And then life went on, and people waited for the dreaded Monday. I could say more about it. It's a whole talk in itself. But it's something people don't know about. It's a very weird place. It had a hospital with 1,000 beds, several operating theaters, weekly medical conferences by the doctors. You have to understand this place, how nuts it was. To give it the illusion that the Germans were taking care of you. That was the idea. When of course they weren't. So that's just in the way of an introduction. And now I'm ready to start my talk. My talk is called After the Holocaust. After the Holocaust, I found myself together with some 2,000 prisoners of the Third Reich, stranded in a village deep in East Germany. Our trip from Bergen-Belsen to Theresienstadt, interrupted by the good soldiers of Marshal Zhukov, who, these soldiers, after they had raped all the local women and thrown the inhabitants out of their homes, told us Jews who came off the train that the village was ours and wished us well. We're talking April 1945. I wasn't yet 3 years old, and I remember little of it. After the Holocaust, in this tranquil village upon a lake called Trobitz, my mother, who now weighed 50 pounds, was raving mad in her typhus delirium. My father was so thin and exhausted that while the embers of life still stirred and rattled within him in this village of 700 well-meaning, homeless Gentile souls, he had long ceased being a self-aware human being. In my mind, he ceased being altogether, so that now I have no memory of him whatsoever. After the Holocaust, a few days after the Russians took us off the train, a few days after the so-called liberation, deep in April, my father died in Trobitz, where he remains politely buried to this day in a mass grave next to the evangelical church. After the Holocaust, my father died three times, first in his mind, then in my mother's, then in mine. He became a victim among victims, a name on a list with a cross next to it, the casualty of Hitler after Hitler was already dead, after the Holocaust. After the Holocaust, for 50 years, until Perestroika, the sign above the two mass graves in the churchyard read, "Hier liegen unsere gefallene Kameraden," here lie our fallen comrades, the victims of the fascist tyranny. For 50 years he lay there, de-Judaized, the Holocaust pursuing him even after he was dead. 50 years he lay there, nameless, stateless, in a well-tended grave, with his only child too terrified to return to that place, swathed as it was in an anesthetized white mist of horror. 50 years later, the new signs were erected in German and in Hebrew, stating the religion of the fallen comrades. Thank you, Mr. Gorbachev, you whose forebearer Zhukov saved me from Hitler, for returning in the realm of signs and signifiers where meaning is most often recovered, for returning Judaism to my father, and for returning him to the Jewish people. after the Holocaust, immediately after, certainly among the sick and dispirited, all sense of time became ethereal. Past and distant past were no longer connected, and hopes for tomorrow had, for many, been so irrevocably battered that for a long time it felt useless, if not forbidden, to contemplate a future. Little wonder, then, that the same people who had never missed a mincha in Bergen-Belsen, who had risked their lives to bake matzah, who had organized clandestine Zionist gatherings among the 30,000 corpses left to the British to bury, little wonder that these same people, in the fine mist of melancholia that settled gently and with little warning upon their broken bodies and souls, did not find in themselves what it took to celebrate Shavuot in Troglitz in May 1945, after the Holocaust. After the Holocaust was it June 1945, my father dead, my mother given up for dead, I found myself alone in the soaking night rain, waiting for a train. I was not yet 3 years old, and I do not remember anyone being with me. Pinned to my chest, a sign that I could not read, in German and Dutch, stating my name and nationality. I fought a black terror I recall with a shudder to this day. I screamed and wept so that my throat hurt. Who would take care of me? No answer. After the Holocaust. After the Holocaust, Holland was in no hurry to welcome back its straggles of Jewish survivors. Some were placed behind barbed wire at the border and had their pitiable effects confiscated and never returned. Some were detained because they had no papers, and some because they were too young to know who they were or who their parents were or whether their parents were alive. When the survivors finally were let in, they were advised that only 70% of their confiscated pre-war assets would be returned to them. Only a near rebellion of the Dutch judiciary resulted in all of it finally being returned to them, provided it could be found. And the children. The governmental committees registered 3,500 displaced children in 1945. Most had been hidden. Many were orphans, some like me, returning from camps, some who had totally lost their identities, without names, with no known families. It was not a given, the Dutch Parliament decreed, that Jewish child survivors would be returned to their parents, if they had any, or to the Jewish community, if they didn't. In the end, 17% of these children remained adopted by Christian, presumably more suitable, families after the Holocaust. And the children. Next. I am riding breathlessly on the back of a scooter, my arms wrapped around the wonderful male jacket in front of me, my head buried deep into it, one eye only taking in the colors, the sun. He and his wife had adopted me. I remember only his back, no face, no name. Gloriously we putter through Elysian fields of golden hay and summer greenery. Let this ride never end, I ask. It does. And we arrive at the Catholic hospital in Eindhoven. Gingerly, he helps me down, fearful of my pallor, my fragility. We are in a room. Everything is white. The ceilings are very high. There is a woman in the bed with the white bars, surrounded by the whole Catholic Church. Nuns, priests. There wasn't a lot of room, and it was getting hot. Someone signals to me to greet her. "Hello, madame," I say. The jacket that brought me this far says, "She is not madame. She is your mother." After the Holocaust. My mother? My whole being rebelled at the word. My body shook. Somewhere inside me, I screamed a cry so grief-struck, so thunderous, that no one was left in the room save for the woman in the bed. I looked at her shattered form, her rheumatic, deformed legs, the Holocaust madness still in her eyes. My mother? Not, I screamed silently, not. The jacket had left. His warmth, his reassurance, puttering into a distance not meant for me. Can a child actually want to die? After the Holocaust. "Yosef," she says. "Yosef, yes, I am your mother." "He doesn't seem to recognize you," the church says. "It is possible that he isn't yours, isn't it?" Children get lost, displaced, mix-ups are common. "We really cannot let you keep this child unless we are sure he is yours. Whoever he is, you can be sure that the church will take very good care of him." She understood the stakes. She always did. That's how we survived. "Yosef," she says. "Yosef, come here." There is kindness in the horror of her form. I come. "He doesn't recognize me," she says to the church, "because the last time he saw me, I weighed 70 pounds less than I do now." "Come, sit," she says to me. "We'll play a little." I want no part of her wretched, morbid form. I don't sit. I feel all vomit. I don't understand the church. She says to the church, "There are too many people in this room. How can I reacquaint myself with my child in the middle of a theater? Can you all please leave?" The church leaves, save for one or two, ostensibly the decision makers. She speaks to me with love, gently, gently. "Do you remember how we used to read Little Red Riding Hood together? How I would read one line and you would finish the rhyme in the next line?" She tries it. I respond haltingly with the rhymes. Soon I cannot control them, and they pour out rhyme after rhyme, verse after verse. Thus did I sing that morning the poetry of Bergen-Belsen, of the corpses I played around, of the typhus feces that were my sandbox. Thus did I sing the song of the hunger and of the fever, of the coal that does not let up, of mother washing my body with her coffee ration. Thus did I sing then, on the morrow after the Holocaust, of the rhymes of the angel of death. Thus did my song echo the rattle in father's chest as he reached up skyward to call out to his brothers, long gone in Sobibor, that he too was coming. The church leaves. There is a drawer in the white, white night table next to the white bed with the white bars. "Open it," she says to me. Inside, a small mountain of foil-covered chocolates. Deep in the mountain, I rescue a small pair of tzitzis and a small, exquisite red sitter. "What are they?" I ask. "You are a Jew," she says to me, "and Jews need these things." Our first conversation after the Holocaust. Albert Conrad Gemmeker was the commandant of Westerbork, the central transit camp in northern Holland, in which 108,000 Dutch Jews were imprisoned and from which they were sent to their deaths, mostly in Auschwitz and Sobibor. Gemmeker was tried in 1946 and sentenced to 10 years, of which he served 7. In the 1970s, he sent a telegram to Israel from his home in Dresden to his childhood friend, the Jewish doctor of Westerbork, on the occasion of the marriage of the doctor's daughter. "Mazel tov," the telegram read in part, after the Holocaust. In Germany, the soldiers of the Wehrmacht, humiliated and exhausted, slowly returned home from the various fronts. They needed pensions, support, a way to resume their lives. While the Nazis' leaders were tried in Nuremberg and elsewhere by the Allies, and the major process of denazification was attempted, much of these efforts were abandoned. Amnesty laws were adopted, particularly by the Adenauer government, which absolved even those known to be guilty of serious Nazi-era crimes. A restitution law was created that mandated reintegrating hundreds of thousands of former Nazi sympathizers dismissed by the Allies, including members of the Gestapo and Waffen-SS, into their old positions throughout the government and professions. The people who presumably ran the trains, or manufactured the ovens and the gas, or shot the Jews or organized their murder, were thus properly taken care of after the Holocaust. And shall we speak of Poland? Shall we speak of Kielce, where in 1946, 42 Jews were murdered in a pogrom, 1946? Shall we speak of Poland, where a major topic of parliamentary debate in the 1930s was, quotes, "the Jewish problem," with ideas about expelling its 3 million Jews to Africa and Madagascar? Shall we speak of Poland, where what came to nothing in the 1930s reached fruition in 1967-68, when most Jews left, having been dismissed from party membership and their places of work and evicted from their apartments, and had no choice, finally, but to leave after the Holocaust? And the children, Dawn, mother and I are living in a home for hapless survivors. A beautiful townhouse in an elegant The Hague neighborhood. It is early 1946. There are photographs of me in this era on a tricycle, my hair carefully parted, a smile in my mouth, and a poker player look in my eye. There are shopping expeditions to the Bijenkorf. Neither mother nor I can get enough of the gorgeous floral displays and merchandising on its massive ground floor. It is thinking about this floor, to her, what heaven was going to look like, she later told me, that helped her bear the latrine called Bergen-Belsen. There is sunshine in The Hague and warm clothing. And then there are the nights. I share a bed with mother, its linen starched and rough against my skin. I move as far away from her as I can, touching the edge of the bed. It is difficult to get warm. With some regularity around 3 a.m., her screams that the police are coming terrify me so that my heart slams in its cage and I sweat the sweat of death itself. I do not know how to manage this madness. I am again unprotected. My daytime naps in this bed are an orgy of my own shrieking and crying. My pillowcase is forever wet. My pale skin develops rashes. I am perfectly toilet trained after the Holocaust. Before the war, there were 35,000 Jews in The Hague. As they were systematically being deported to Westerbork, the three lay leaders of the Orthodox Kehillah, Mr. Zadok, Mr. Levison, and Mr. Drilsman, pledged that if they were given the privilege of surviving, whatever lay before them, then when all this was over and the community regathered itself, they would organize the Kehillah anew. This was kind of a neder. By some miracle, the three actually survived and met to make good their pledge. They waited and waited then for their tarrying brothers and sisters to return. Only then did they see the enormity of the Holocaust. Only then did they grasp with pounding hearts the terror of its sweep. The Jews did not return. 105,000 out of 135,000 of Holland's Jews had been murdered, the highest per capita death rate in all of Europe, save for Greece. The streets that had been filled with worshippers on their way to services every week, the women in their finery, the men in their top hats, the mothers, the fathers, the children, the old people with their canes who each week crowded the sidewalks, the streets were now empty and hollow, silenced forever by the fatal roar of the Gestapo motorcycles and the klaxons of the Dutch police who together had collected them. On the 9th of June, 1945, a handful of hidden Jews and survivors attended the first Shabbat service. These three men's lives had been defined by the Kehillah. The Kehillah made them who they were, but structure to all they found meaningful. From the Kehillah they drew meaning, in the Kehillah they located their pride. Zadok, I think, was the last to go. He made Aliyah in the 1970s, after the Holocaust. After the Holocaust, Pesach 1946, the Jewish Home for Survivors in The Hague sold its chametz. I have in my possession the original certificate of sale. The Jews gathered at the table for my first Seder, battered, limping, palsied, unreal, snuffling with joy, without joy, barely looking at each other. We sang Dayenu that year. That was the year I learned the melody. They sang Dayenu that year. These Jews who in Westerbork had witnessed the hospital being emptied and its patients put on the trains to Auschwitz, thereby putting to bed any illusion that Auschwitz was a labor camp. These self-same Jews who, with the arrival of a new train every Tuesday morning, heard the death knell toll for them, these Jews sang, "If you had taken care of us in the wilderness, Almighty Law God, and not provided us with the manna, Dayenu, that would have been enough." They sang Dayenu that year, these Jews, who had their children snatched screaming from their hands in Westerbork and tossed onto the train to Sobibor. These self-same Jews who waved to their children as the train pulled out of the camp, a train no one in heaven nor upon earth saw fit to stop. These Jews sang, "If you had given us the manna, Almighty God, and had not given us the holy Shabbos, Dayenu, that would have been enough." They sang Dayenu that year, these Jews who had witnessed the departure of the last train that was to leave Westerbork for the east, the train filled with the unbekannte Kinder, the unknown children, the ones whose parents had preceded them on the train trips to the gases and the shootings and the burnings, the children who had forgotten their names, who were inarticulate, who were pre-articulate, who held each other's hands, the terror in their eyes. These self-same Jews who screamed and never again slept through the night for having seen those eyes. These Jews sang, "If you had given us the holy Shabbos, Almighty God, and had not given us the Torah, Dayenu, that would have been enough." They wept through Dayenu that year after the Holocaust. And so it came to pass that at the end of December 1948, my mother and I, on a train from the port of New York to Montreal, crossed the Canadian border at Rouse's Point and made our way to grandmother's apartment at 4485A Esplanade Avenue. There, my mother's mother stared purposely at her daughter, took her in, gazed at a young woman whose hands were already gnarled from rheumatic arthritis, whose legs were bent and stiff and distended, and who could not stand straight, and who walked very poorly. So it came to pass that grandmother looked over her daughter and perceived in an instant the horrors that had befallen her. So it came to pass that mother said to daughter in quiet, certain terms, "I do not want ever to hear about what you went through in Europe. You are starting a new life here after the Holocaust." Reverend Ronis was a short, firm, handsome man, mustache, silver-framed glasses, and a cleft chin. He arrived in our apartment calmly one evening to teach me to read Hebrew. Several such evenings transpired. Grandmother let him in. He removed his coat, then his fedora. He put on an elegant black kippah, sat down at the kitchen table, and the lesson would begin. The Hebrew alphabet is simple to learn, as are its separate vowels, and I mastered it in no time in the early Montreal winter evenings, in the warmth of the apartment with its blonde furniture and hard sofas, and in the calm warmth of my teacher's kindness. He was all business, as he assumed what is by far Judaism's most sacred ministry, extending the tradition to the next generation. But my learning was destined to be different from all other learnings. When children are finally ready to put consonant and vowel together to read, then what is normally chosen for them is the Shema, quiet acceptance of God's unity and our submission to and vulnerability before His grandeur and omniscience. The curriculum for me was different. The thrill of finally being able to read those beautiful letters was served on a cold tray of morbidity. Yiskadal, the Yiskadash, I read. "You need to recite the prayer for the dead," they said to me, "for your father." And they were in a hurry. I was dispatched alone at dawn to the synagogue around the corner, where I found myself in a row of mourners reciting Kaddish, swaying slowly in a faithful rhythm. Men in their 50s and 60s, working class, Yiddish speaking, grief-stricken for their departed loved ones. I stood among them and did my duty for my ghostly father, whom I did not remember and did not love, and whom I wished was here to guide me. Reverend Ronis stopped coming. The Kaddish sayers had something about them. The synagogue saves the mourner's Kaddish for the end of the service. The mourners come from all points of the sanctuary and stand in front of the ark, facing the ark, firmly and resolutely accepting God's kingship and providence, the finality of His decisions about who shall live and who shall die. These particularly tired European immigrants, mostly Polish, many survivors, didn't walk to the front. They shuffled and dragged their feet. They wore old creaky shoes from Opatov and Czestochowa, from Chelm and from Lodz. Their feet raised the dreary dust of endless Jewish wandering, and as they came together from all ends of the sanctuary, they frightened me with their unpressed suit pants and their weary bulks. I heard a thunder in their gait, and as I gathered in between them each morning, barely reaching their waists, intimidated by the din, calmed by no one, I felt shame at having been to a kingdom no one would ever talk about. 3 years later, I continued to have an embarrassingly deathly pallor which mother explained to have come from the worst case of jaundice in all of Bergen-Belsen, a pallor so alarming that I was constantly stared at and yet never questioned about. I was also deeply ashamed of occasionally having to sit with mother in the synagogue in the upstairs woman balcony, and again, unlike the other kids, of having no father after the Holocaust. So that's the memoir. The message I want you to hear, many messages, and you'll hear what you need to hear, is that the result of his three independent studies, good studies, sociological studies or psychological, I don't know, each done by Reform rabbis for some reason, independently, I don't know if they knew of each other's work, show that survivors who were observant and Shomer Mitzvot before the Holocaust remained so after the Holocaust at an alarmingly high rate, 90%, 95%. And, I mean, the logic of it is really not complicated. Holocaust survivors are not theologians, and they're certainly not prepared to let Hitler decide whether or not they're going to be frum. I don't think it's more complicated than that. Because I was in Auschwitz, I shouldn't keep Shabbos. Do you want to help me figure that out? Shabbos is beautiful. Shabbos is gorgeous. Shabbos is the greatest, etc., etc., etc. It's a very important, fundamental, simple lesson. I talked about this part of my talk to a survivor, and he said, it's not true. He said, I lost my faith in the Holocaust. I said, talk to me. I said, tell me what you were doing just before the Holocaust. Were you going to shul? Were you putting on tefillin every day? And he looked at me ruefully. He says, no. He says, I was already giving it up. Case proved. I want to end with a little bit of Torah. I mean, the scene with my mother, right, in the hospital, it never dawned on her. It never dawned on her not to keep Shabbos. I'll tell you one story. It's not in my script. I heard this from a Dutch survivor in Jerusalem about three summers ago. I go around interviewing these crazy people, and each of them makes me cry, and they're all beautiful. He told me about his mother, and her name was Mrs. Abrahams, and he told me that, I mean, you understand about Bergen-Belsen, as these things go, was an okay place to be until the end of December 1944. It was okay. There was food, it wasn't pleasant, it was a harsh prison, but there was nobody dying. The death rates were normal. And so here you have 7,500 people in this camp, they're making it. Starting in December 44, the Nazis start emptying all the other camps because they're losing the war and they want to destroy the camps. And the inmates start their infamous death marches, and their goal, their destination is Bergen-Belsen. So by mid-January 1945, a camp that had been built for 7,500 inmates suddenly has close to 30,000 inmates, with no increase in sanitation, no increase in food, and no increase in living quarters. And where typhus is rampant. And so this woman is there during this time. A friend of mine, I don't remember this, but I have a friend in Montreal who was with me there, and he's a year older. I wish I had the other year. Maybe I don't. He tells me that we were playing in Bergen-Belsen, we were playing hide and seek among the corpses. There are thousands upon thousands of corpses, more corpses than there is time to bury. When the British finally liberated in mid-April, they had 30,000 corpses to bury. And the people were still dying for weeks and months. So this woman, Mrs. Abrahams, takes a slice of bread out of the hands of somebody who had just died. And she is caught. And some idiot reports her to the Gestapo. And when she is reported, they had a system. A trial was held. The lawyers and the judges were the finest Jewish lawyers and judges from all of Europe. And there is the trial. And the prosecuting lawyer says to the woman, to Mrs. Abrahams, "You know that the law is that you cannot take food from anybody in this camp that isn't directly assigned to you. This is called stealing. And the penalty for stealing in Bergen-Belsen is very serious." She looks him straight in the eye and says nothing. The defense attorney says to her, "Surely you have a reason that you did that would explain your behavior. Please tell us." She looks at him, doesn't say a word. Finally, the judge, in a moment of desperation, says, "Mrs. Abrahams, you do understand that unless you give some kind of a rationale for doing this, you're going to go for 3 days and three nights underground into the brig, and you will receive no food and no water. Please tell us why you did it." And she looks at him dead in the eye, says nothing. Put her in the brig for 3 days and three nights. She comes out more dead than alive. And her husband is in a rage at her. He says, "What the heck do you think you were doing? Why did you open your mouth?" She says, "The prosecuting attorney was sitting there with a pencil and a paper. The defense attorney was sitting there with a pencil and a paper. And the judge was sitting there with a pencil and a paper, and it was Shabbos. I wasn't about to make three Jews write on Shabbos." If she had asked the Shaila of a Rav, he would have told her she's crazy. But I'm trying to explain to you power of Torah inside these people, and how they weren't about to let the most horrifying experiences known in human history to affect Shabbos. It's something to understand that. When Hannah Arendt writes, "They went like sheep to slaughter," I think of the story. And, you know, give me a break, Hannah. We believe that God created the world according to Midat Hadin, according to justice and to righteousness, and that the laws of justice and righteousness are immutable. And if that's the case, I want to bring you to the story of the binding of Isaac in the Bible, the Akedah, and ask Abraham, our father, one chapter ago, you said to God, listen, God, you can't destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. There may be some good people there. Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, shall the judge of all the earth not do justice? He knew the question. Why did he ask it about Isaac? Son? Gemara says, Yitzchak Eila Tnima Haisa, he was the holiest man who ever lived. Why did Abraham not open his mouth and say, God, you can't do this. He's a sweet kid. He's a beautiful kid. And he didn't do it. And the Sfasemes somewhere says that if you look carefully in the Chumash, God never spoke to Abraham again after that. To understand that, I want to bring you a chapter earlier. Quoting now in English from the Chumash, the sun was risen upon the earth when Lot came to Tzoar. Then the Lord caused to rain upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire out of the Lord, out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. That's when he was arguing about Sodom and Gomorrah, right? He went back to the exact same place, and I resume my reading here, and he looked towards Sodom and Gomorrah and towards all the land of the plain, and behold, and lo, the smoke of the land went up as the smoke of the furnace. Abraham comes to the place that was Sodom, the Torah tells us, and sees a crater. He sees Hiroshima. What is he doing there? What is the purpose of this visit? The Torah provides us with no information whatsoever. Sepharno does. Abraham had indeed pleaded on behalf of Sodom, Sepharno says, at this very spot, pounding the anvil of justice, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, shall the judge of all the earth not ask justly, Abraham asks, shall the God of all the earth punish the innocent together with the guilty? But where, Sepharno asks, was the anvil not of justice, but of what? Of mercy. Perhaps Abraham should have said, look, God, there may indeed not be a single righteous person in the town, but do you have to rain down fire on innocent children? And are you not also a God who is loving and compassionate? Erech apayim v'rach chesed. So Abraham returned here to this very spot, argues Sepharno, to plead for Sodom, this time from the perspective not of justice, but of what? Of mercy. But it is too late. Abraham arrives at his prayer spot and sees the crater, the Hiroshima, with the smoke still hovering over it, and remains silent. So it is that we finally understand why Abraham does not intercede on behalf of his son, his only son, the one that he loves, Isaac. We finally understand why he is able to beg for the lives of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah and not that his own child be soon thereafter spared. For perhaps Abraham felt that God would then have said to him, aha, for your own child you plead for compassion. But where were you when you should have been pleading for compassion for the children of Sodom and Amalek? Where did Sepharno get this idea from? Where did it come from? I'll end on this. Well, he got it from Midrashim. And I found some of the Midrashim. God says to Abraham, we just read this in the Haggadah, right? you need to know that your nation will is going to be in Egypt for 400 years, and they will suffer, and they will be persecuted, and they will have hard work. Midrash, I have it right here, excoriates Abraham for not saying, "Excuse me, God, have compassion on my children." Why does he accept the prophecy without arguing? Some even argue in these midrashim. Here, I read it to you: Korei li avota olam v'omer lehem gezerot kashat gezarti al b'neichem v'lo bikashtem aleihem rachamim. Or b'pnei ma'ro item shchinati mistaleket uveiti charev ubanai golu v'lo bikashtem aleihem rachamim. Why Abraham? Why Isaac? Why Jacob? You knew this was coming. Why didn't you cry out to God and say, "Have mercy"? We say that the world works according to the laws of science. We believe that. We say that the world follows Midas Hadin, God's sense of justice and order. And so we say that, you know, God didn't, God forbid, create the Holocaust. No, the Nazis did, and all the people who watched and didn't do anything did. And who didn't let Jews in did. It wasn't God. But I want to tell you something. That if we don't ask God, "How could you allow this to happen?" then we would be breaking egregiously from the tradition of the Sephorno and of the Midrash. And although no observant Jew before the Holocaust stopped keeping Shabbos or stopped doing Chesed because of the Holocaust, that does not give us license not to continue asking the questions of God. Because if we don't ask the questions, what Sephorno and the Midrashim are saying is that God will challenge us, because he wants us to ask that question. Thank you very much. The implication, I think, is that God is very disappointed, and that Abraham did not pass the test. That is one possible interpretation. Some years I believe it, and some years I'm too firm to believe that. So it depends. But that is a possible interpretation. Sure. It can go either way.
Presumably, you have asked the question and others have asked the question. I'm just wondering what answer you've received. To your question of why God did you allow this to happen?
I think it has to do with God giving humanity ever greater freedom. He's really saying, "Guys, history is in your hands. I am not coming in. This is not Egypt. And yeah, you understand, you're speaking to a guy whose total survival is one miracle after another. I told a fraction of the stories of my survival. Okay, understanding that, and that I'm grateful to God beyond words goes without saying. Maybe it doesn't. But the fact of the matter is that God is saying to us, he's giving us far more autonomy about our lives and our destiny than he has ever given anybody. And I have several examples of that. Right? Today, in a few years, somebody will take DNA out of some woman's ear, fertilize it, put it in her womb, and she will have a child without any benefit of a man. That's in the cards. It's going to happen one day. Capacity. This is a kind of autonomy we've never had. Never had that. We're deciding stuff that at one point was a given from Gan Eden. Number two, Jonathan Schell wrote a book a couple of years ago, which he talked about the fact that in the old days, an army fought another army, a lot of people got killed, but even in World War I, we weren't able to extinguish all of humanity. Now we have that capacity. Send a couple of bombs in the right direction, and all of humanity is wiped out. Man, society has been given the capacity for total suicidal extinction. That is a new liberty that I think that Hashem gave us. Do I understand why? No. But I think part of what's happening is this. There are other examples that I could give. But things are changing. You guys want to kill yourself by making holes in the ozone layer? I'm not going to protect you. You got to take care of the world. I put you into the world. Take care of it. So I think it has something to do with that. That's how I interpret it. I am the greatest recipient of Midas Harachamim that is imaginable. God blessed me with Kenei Nahara, 5 children, 6 grandchildren, and when we get together on Pesach, ain't nothing like it. And I read you my first Pesach after Bergen-Belsen. So who am I to say that God doesn't have Rachamim? I am not in a position to say that. But I am in a position to ask the question. Yeah, other questions? Yeah.
Talk before, I'm paraphrasing, about the need to confront in the moment, challenge God. Do you think God has been listening? And if so, how has God responded?
How in the world can I say, after what I went through, that God wasn't listening? I can't say that. I can't say that. You know, I can't say that. God has been spectacular to me. Somebody prayed, and he listened.
I don't mean to put him, I mean,
no, but you can only talk about this person.
Confrontation with or a challenge to God over what happened in a national perspective. Has God been listening? Has God been responding?
When my time comes, and I'm going to go to heaven, I'm heading directly to where the 1.5 million children who didn't make it are hanging out. And I'm going to say, because I have these skills, how's it going? That's what I mean by challenging God.
Would you say that the state of Israel being a response?
Okay, thanks. The state of Israel being a response of God, that's, I think, to me, an obvious idea. And B, I guess I'm a little troubled by the notion, of course we have to question God, but And that is a long, you know, part of our tradition for thousands of years, of course. The question is, I guess, where do you draw the line? Because, and maybe I'll ask the question in the generation where most Jews are not observant and don't accept that God is the master of the universe. I think perhaps that some of these questions were easier in a time when it was a given and wouldn't accept or affect us halachically or frumkeit, however you want to call it. But perhaps in our generation, I don't really know the answer, I'm just throwing out the thought, perhaps in our generation it's a little different and we have to be more careful on how we address God, and maybe a few short comments.
I don't think so. I think that the place to address God and ask him the toughest questions in the world is the Beit Midrash or the Shabbos table, or when you're doing some mitzvah or other that you love, that you're doing with all your heart. That's the time. The way to challenge God has always seemed to me to be from the inside. From the inside. And he has to be challenged. What are you talking about? I mean, he's disappointed. That's what I showed you. He's midrashing. The Bali Medrash say that God is disappointed that the Avos didn't challenge him for Rachamim. So I'm not doing anything radical. But with respect to the state of Israel, you know, God is funny. He gives us the Torah. He gives us mitzvahs. He's not always clear about what he did that for and what it means. And he kind of leaves that to us. So here we have the reestablishment of the Jewish polity after 2,000 years. Did it happen because God helped us? I could certainly interpret that way. Is that a necessary interpretation? Or could I say that when Ben-Gurion ran out of money, he walked from Yaffa to Yerushalayim to get his business done. And he and thousands of others worked like dogs for over 100 years, starting from the Dreyfus trial and even before, when the Gra sent his people and the Baal Shem Tov sent his people to Eretz Yisrael. That's why Eretz Yisrael happened. It's some combination. I never remove the hand of God from anything. But I got to be real careful. Maybe I'll tell you a story that addresses the conundrum here. I get very nervous with people who have who are certain about interpretations, like the people who say it was Yad Hashem. I'm not going to say it wasn't Yad Hashem. I'm a believer. I say every morning, I believe that God is present in all the things that we do, and, you know, guides us, and so I believe all of that. One of my students had a child, and then she wanted another child. She was in Israel. So she goes, and she can't have something. Her plumbing is not working, and she can't have this kid. So she goes to a mekubal, to a Kabbalist, and she goes to the Kabbalist, and she says, "Tell me, give me some spiritual direction, so that I can conceive." He says, "Let me see your ketubah." So he brings her, she brings him the ketubah. He says, "There are several errors in this ketubah. Let me write you a new one." And he writes her a new one, and guess what? 30 days later, she conceives. So there's a part of me that's a Litvak, even though I'm a Dutch Jew. And I'm at her house, and I said, "Show me the two ketubahs." She says, "Do you really want to see them?" I said, "Yeah, I'm on a Beit Din. I know about ketubahs. I know how they work. I know how to write them. I'm very critical of everybody who brings a ketubah in. Like, let me look at it." So she brings in the two ketubahs. And indeed, there are errors on the first ketubah. But the ketubah that he wrote was an unbelievable disaster, with more errors on it exponentially than the first one. Okay? Now, did the Kabbalist, you know, affect the pregnancy? Did he have the pull with Hashem? It's a question of interpretation. She did get pregnant. And that's the conundrum.
I guess a little bit of what I'm saying is A, the Midrashim are probably a minority opinion, and the opinion is sort of, and that's fine. Our tradition has strands, and sometimes in different historical periods, I think one strand of interpretation has to play more weight. That is true. I guess the other thing, or Soloveitchik always used to say that we shouldn't ask why or lama, but is lima, for what purpose. So I think we have that, but the question is, how do you ask a question? And there's a huge difference between asking why it happened and what we can learn from what happened. And I guess the question is, where do you draw the line?
You're not really talking to God when you're doing that. You really want to look God's kaviyachol in the eye and say to him, 1.5 million children, what was that about? And I'm not talking about Lamar. I'm really not interested in explanations, to tell you. But what I am interested in...
There aren't any.
Well, the people in the camp that you are describing say there are explanations, except we don't know what they are. But they never read Dostoevsky, who said, I'm not interested in explanations. What I'm saying to you is that the frum Jew who looks God in the eye, so to speak, kaviyachol, and challenges from the moment of candle lighting for Shabbos, and says, I love you, God. I'm not giving up your Torah, not for one second. And I teach my kids to say Shema every night. And I'm not messing around with any of that, because I believe it and I love it. And I feel that it's the greatest gift ever given to humanity. But could you please tell me what you had in mind by not interfering with 1.5 million children who died? And ask the question directly. That's what the Bali Midrash means, I think.
Yeah, in 120 years...
Last question.
And you're up there, and you meet these 1.5 million children who are not the recipients of the Midat HaRachamim that you were. What do you say to them?
The first chapter of my autobiography that I'm writing takes place in heaven, in which I'm discussing, arguing whether I want to go down altogether. And I'm in the room with all of these kids. And when the book comes out, it's a very hard question. It's a very hard question. I think the most important thing that I could do is what I learned to do as a professional in Jewish life, which is to listen and to validate. That's a lot.
Okay. Rabbi Stern, as the host, will... Achron Achron Chaviv.
I'm more than a host, Rabbi Pollack. Maybe you'll tell them. We are... Well, Mishpacha, put it that way. No, I'm not sure what I want to say. I was listening to Jay very carefully, Rabbi Kelman, my friend, and I tend to agree, with what he is saying. The rabbis, in Pirkei Avos, do say Chachamim Hizharu B'Divrayim. We have to be very careful with the language we use and what effect it has. And the reality is what happened, in my opinion, what happened 50, 60 years ago, one has to be almost paralyzed emotionally not to have any questions. Everybody, obviously, there's no different, the question of 1.5 million children and some 6 million Jews than I deal with every day with families and parents, and that one-year-old child dies of cancer. You can have the same question. There's a concept, there's a Judaism, there's a Munas Hashem. There is an aspect of belief and faith and understanding. There's a final destiny. And I think what Rabbi Kelman was trying to say, that in a generation and in an age, when we do see this shift, like we do have Balei Tshuva, thank God, more Jews are returning to Judaism, but the vast majority of Jews are not connected. We have so much assimilation and intermarriage. Figures in some communities are staggering. And to throw out questions that we know deep down we have no answer. Ultimately, as Rabbi Pollack says, after 120 years, maybe we'll ask, maybe we'll find out something. I don't know. But there's some questions that now have no answers. But when we raise them in this kind of context and implant or embed in the neshama, the soul of people, these kind of doubts and feelings, well, if a rabbi is asking these questions and he has these doubts, so what am I doing putting on film every morning? Maybe I should...
Which rabbi has doubts?
Not doubts. What I mean by doubts, by raising these kind of questions and explaining or saying that there are different forms of interpretation, and the reality is there are no answers to that question. I mean, that's, you know, you talked before about simple, pushing reality. The reality is we can't answer that question. I go to the Y here every day. I meet these survivors of the Holocaust every single day. Literally, I was going to say 300, I'm not there on Shabbos, Yom Tov, 300 days a year. We go through this over and over again. There are no answers. There's some questions that have no answers. And by implanting these continuous questions in the minds of people, it reinforces their lack of belief. It reinforces their reason not to observe. The frumli yid will observe, you're right. But if we are out to mekarev, to teach people and to give them hope and reasons to reconnect and to become observant Jews, I don't know what we're gaining by raising these kind of questions. That's a gut reaction I have.
Moshe, your question is right on. Let me answer it. I can tell you that when I've spoken to secular crowds or crowds of survivors who are not observant, they come over to me and hug me and they say, you're the first honest rabbi I've ever met, and that because of you I'm going to start coming to shul on Shabbos morning. That's one of the consequences. Not all of it. It is empirical. I just want to say that in 1953, my mother remarried in Montreal a very nice man who was the brother of Rabbi Stern's grandfather. And we were raised in each other's homes for a long time. And you weren't here when I started, or else I would have said, and it's a great, great, I haven't seen you in, I think, God knows how many years.
We've talked, yeah.
It's a great privilege for me to be here, and maybe we can end on that.
Yes. Thank you very much.